For December the 10th, 2021, we talk about Shin Megami Tensei 5, Endzone, A World Apart, and Spiritfarer. Welcome to Level 396. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Furia.
I'm Jella Prendes.
And I'm Ben Merkel.
And you are listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. Welcome back, Jella.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I've been very busy.
Yeah. What you been up to? Anything cool? Anything you want to talk about?
I watched the Ghostbusters Afterlife movie, and it's a very nice movie, and I very much enjoyed it. So I would recommend if you grew up with the original Ghostbusters movies, understand that this one is more like a drama than it is like a comedy action movie,
yeah.
But it's a very good movie and I would recommend watching.
Nice. Now the Ghostbusters, they're not ladies this time, are they?
No, this is like the original. Well, it's not even the original cast. The original cast kind of pops in at the end, but this is Egon's grandchildren because Harold Ramis, the guy who played Egon, passed away in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So they could not do a new Ghostbusters movie with him, but his likeness is in the movie, and he does play a very, very important. He's one of the most central pivotal points of the entire movie. So anyway, it's worth watching.
Yeah. No, I mean, the idea, ghosts, I'm fine. Magic boxes that can seal these spirits away. Okay, I'm rolling for this. But a lady using that box.
I actually never did watch that one just because the trailer for that one just didn't hit the right notes for me.
Yeah, I am obviously making fun of people who took that way too seriously. Dennis, it sounded like you had an opinion.
No, I was also making fun of people who took it too seriously.
I gotcha.
And harkening back to the, which was the original, like, Battlefield something or other. Back when Battlefield games were good, remember?
Right.
And they were complaining that there were women in World War II or something like that.
Oh, it was Battlefield 1, where it was like, yeah. No, I just, it's funny. Yeah, no, it's actually fucking miserable. Sorry, I'm going to pull up from that one. I'm glad you enjoyed that movie.
Yeah, like I probably will go back and watch the one that I missed. But also I did buy the Ghostbusters remastered version of the old video game. So I will be playing that.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Switch at some point as well. But as I will be talking about, I'm in the middle of some other very involved games at the moment. So I don't know when I will play that one that I picked up and added to my backlog. How's everybody else?
Well, yeah. No, I have a question, Jala.
Oh,
I need to know.
What?
Have you kept up with Stranger Things at all?
No, I don't watch anything about Stranger Things, but I'm aware that the guy who plays the grandson is from that.
Yeah, and it's too much ghostiness proximity there. I feel like those are too close to each other, and I wouldn't be able to watch it without just constantly wondering when the rest of the Stranger Things characters are going to show up.
Is this going to be a crossover?
He's honestly not really the main character. The main character is Egon's granddaughter, Phoebe, who is baller as fuck. She's Egon 2.0.
Cool.
So I definitely enjoyed her. And also there's a character named Podcast who was Dave's absolute favorite character. And guess what he does? He does a podcast. Did you know?
we're making it after all. Mainstream, baby.
Yeah.
If people heard Discord sounds during that, it's because we're using the backup recording and
it died.
Yeah. Yeah. Our little recorder probably died, but it is too much work to bring it back, and it will probably disconnect anyway. So I apologize for that.
Feed AI stages walkouts.
Sure.
Our production level is like the same as Ghostbusters too, right?
Oh man. Ben, how about you? What's up?
I'm doing all right. I've had a busy week at work. I think it's finally will be done by the end of today. So I'll be happy with the rest of the week. And I think it'll be pretty chill from here on out. So.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. Any plans for like active decompression? You got anything you're looking to do?
I'll probably start running again because I haven't ran in like the past like 10 days or so.
Hmm.
So yay. That'll be yay. A nice stress reliever.
Not yay that you haven't run in 10 days. Yay that you're getting back to it.
Yeah. Nice. But the flip side is I don't drink anything when I'm on call. So like the weight just stays the same. It balances out, you know?
Nice. Dennis, how about you?
Today was a red letter day. The day we record this is Barrett's first birthday.
Oh my gosh, that went by very fast.
Yeah.
From my perspective, I don't know for you, but
holy crap. That was a quick year we had. He is 1 year old now.
Nice.
And determined to anytime that you are not directly watching him, just dash. Or wait, what's the right word for dashing while crawling?
Crash.
Crash.
I want to say skitter, but no person should skitter. So that's a callback to a title.
Determined to crash over to the staircase and start climbing it.
That's his
thing. And we've got a baby gate on it, but we also have two young kids who don't understand the concept of no, seriously, your brother will fall down the stairs. It gets left open all the time. At first, like when he first discovered it, he would get too pleased with himself and he would make it onto like the very first step is a landing.
Okay.
And he'd be so happy. He'd start doing like a kind of like just excited for himself. And so that was our alarm. Now he's getting more savvy and he stays quiet until he's like halfway up the stairs. Then he's too pleased with himself and starts laughing. And so that is our life with a 1 year old now is, when might the baby be making a break for upstairs? And the answer is, can you see him? No, then he's making a break for upstairs.
Is it set up like a motion detector that'll make like a little chime whenever something moves past, you know,
yes.
it's like, Jen was carrying some laundry up and down or whatever. Dennis was carrying laundry up and down. I understand. That's a normal chime. If it's a bad chime, Metal Gear alert. Yeah.
Just tie a weight to him.
Yeah. Just put him under a laundry hamper.
How many pounds can my baby carry?
Yeah, let's get a buff baby. You know?
Little buff boys. No, you don't want to introduce evolutionary pressure. You end up a little baby Hercules. He tries to surmount it. Yeah.
Right now, if I catch him, I can stop him from going up the stairs. I fear the world where that is not the case.
Yeah. Bright siding things is a bad habit, but it sounds good that he's not timid about it, that he is curious and, you know,
I'll get behind him and like just follow him up the stairs. So I'll let him climb it. I just make sure I'm there.
Right.
Which I probably solidifies in his mind that it's play, but also he's experienced on the stairs now. And like I'm less worried about him falling in the times where he will get to them and we just don't realize in time. So.
Right. And also like if he's confident about it, he's less likely to hesitate and probably fall. I don't know. That sounds nerve wracking. I'm trying to give you reasons not to feel, not to feel like you're crazy about that.
Oh, it's all craziness over here.
Yeah.
But yeah. You know, survived a full year with three kids. I will wait for my medal in the mail.
Oh, man. Thanks, Ben, for posting a screen from the Little Buff Boys competition. Yeah. I don't have too much going on over here. I've mostly been on the downslope of Fallout 4, which is nice. That has been I've not completed the last expansion yet, but I have put in 105 hours on that, which is the most I have done on any game for WoW outside, I think, of The Witcher 3. So, that is and The Witcher 3 was like we did the main thing and then we did both expansions over the course of the next year. It's been a big one, you know, and I know that I'm just talking about playing video games in the not video games portion of the show, but it does, you know, it kind of like monopolize, it makes you anxious having all that in front of you. And so I'm happy to be near the other side of it, let's say.
Yeah. You know, taglines like, you know, hundreds of hours of play or infinite replayability start feeling like threats rather than promises.
Yes. Yeah. So, and it was, you know, nobody forces us to do any of these things. I agreed to do.
That's not true. Cole's forcing us.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. All I heard was some static there. That was a weird edit. I'm going to leave a marker there. Yeah. So that's been nice. So I can focus on other things, such as getting ready for Duckstream, which is going to be happening as people are hearing this, begins in a week. December 17th, 18th, and 19th, 48 hours. It'll be fun. I've not decided like what horror game I'm going to put up there, but, we'll figure it out. It is tough to plan. So, I think we should talk about video games. Jolly, you said you've been playing some really involved stuff that I want to hear about. So why don't we do the regular kind of show, what with the grind, the multiplayer, and the end boss, and get started with
The Grind.
The Grind, where we talk about the games we've been playing over the past period of time or so. Jolla, I'm going to throw it to you.
Okay, so I promise that although these are involved games, they will not take me as long to talk about as Fire Emblem. So, the first one is Shin Megami Tensei 5, which I had mentioned previously that I was going to be playing this game when I finally got a copy of it. So, I finally got my copy, as everyone knows from the last time I was on. So, I have put in a good 25-ish hours so far. Ooh. So, it is a JRPG released November 12th, 2021, developed by Atlus in Unreal Engine 4, which was actually a first for Atlus. This engine allowed them to spend more time on trial and error and coming up with ideas because they were able to create something and then immediately see it in the game world. So I don't know how their method was before this, but anyway, that was just something of note. So, story-wise, you follow the life and times of yet another boring high school student who gains magical powers and goes on an adventure between modern-day Tokyo and the Netherworld, which is full of demons. The story is the same tripe as always, a war between demons and angels, chaos and law, taking place, of course, at Tokyo Tower. Pretty early in, you find out that your modern-day life is a figment of the imagination of God, and it ceased to exist 18 years ago when the big war happened, and you end up getting roped in by the people from Bethel to help prevent the demons from taking over. How, you ask? You inexplicably fuse with a proto-fiend, that name made me giggle, named Aogami, which just means blue god. Anyway, who is a construct created by Bethel?
Okay.
You yourself are a sort of demon and also enlist demons that you come across and fuse them together in the weirdest possible fusion concert underneath a booby lady who becomes very large. It's a thing. And I don't have videos because they won't allow me to record videos, but I have plenty of screenshots on my Twitter. So... as usual, all the demons are super horny, just like they were in SMT4. And it's grindy, and to me, the story is really not the reason I'm playing it. Mm-hmm. I have no idea why.
You're only
why.
Playing it for the booby ladies?
Booby ladies and, like, you know, Mara. Yeah, of course. No. Anyway, I just like catching Pokemon and mashing them together. So anyway, I don't actually know why, but there is a DLC side quest with menorahs of mass destruction. Like, you have a menorah that brings you to doom critters that you get their menorah after you fight them, and then you go off to the next person's. But I don't know what the hell is going on. I mean, but anyway, there's menorahs involved.
Menorahs, like from the Festival of Lights.
Arbitrarily, I don't even know. It's not explained. Anyway, that's the story.
It's not like Atlus to use religious imagery from a bunch of different faiths in kind of a weird and haphazard way.
Oh yeah, there's a bunch of stuff from different folklores, different faiths, and all kinds of crap. All just kind of it's very funny to me because I dig folklore and mythology and things like that, and I actively have studied that. So like whenever I come across their interesting rendition of one or another critter or god or what have you, it always just kind of makes me laugh or shake my head or both.
I mean, it's one of the draws of the series. Yeah.
Yeah, is just to see what they're doing.
Yeah.
So, anyway, when it was released, it had generally favorable reviews, and it was the highest-selling physical video game of the week in Japan and outperformed other JRPGs in the UK. So, I guess it did not do as well here because there was no mention about how well it sold in America. But
it was constantly sold out. I know that.
I know that, too, because that was part of what caused the drama of me not being able to get a copy of this game. So anyway, so let me go ahead and talk a little bit about the gameplay. There's a few things I will mention about that, and then that'll wrap up talking about this game unless you have questions. So cool. This installment has a really, really huge world. The Tokyo overworld is similar to the overworld in 4, but the areas you play in once you arrive in a new map are just huge. And there's a bunch of like dilapidated buildings, and you can jump up and run around a bunch of different floors and stuff in you know, post-apocalyptic Tokyo in the netherworld. So you have a Naruto run that you can do it's a Naruto run. Because you guys don't know anything about that.
No, I know the meme.
You know that one. Okay, so his arms are straight back, like, you know, straight back to the sides, and he's leaning forward, and he's just like, do. Well, that's how this dude runs. And you speedily dodge around enemies on the map because they are physically there, and they're not just shadows. Like, you actually see what you're going to be fighting.
It's like dodge around Final Fantasy X. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you slash at them, because you do have the ability to slash at stuff, that basically gives you the initiative when it switches to the battle screen, because it takes you out of the active time map into a turn-based battle map.
And that's a change from 4 and Apocalypse, right? 4 and Apocalypse, those were action RPGs. Am I correct?
No.
Oh. I was mistaken.
At least not the one that, not 4. I don't know if Apocalypse was, because I didn't play Apocalypse.
I think they both played the same. I had a misconception about those games.
Well, you walked around, but like when you came across a shadow or a demon or whatever, then it switched to a battle map.
Gotcha. So,
okay, so then when you go into combat, you yourself are fighting along with 3 different demons, and you can switch out demons for others that you have summoned at the moment, but that takes a movement, and you basically have like a bar with every round you have a bar with one blip on it for each person who, you know, you have in your party. So if you only have 3 demon or 3 people total, you and 2 demons, then you only have 3 blips, that kind of thing. And if you say, for example, miss when you're trying to attack the enemy, you lose 2 blips instead of 1 blip. And if you do a critical, you gain an extra blip in that kind of thing. So like they do stuff with that penalizes you if you miss and encourages you to, of course, get crits or hit weaknesses, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, as I mentioned before, this is grindy. You want to roam around the map for a while, exploring everything for secrets, side quests, and treasures. It's not super absurdly, like, for Shin Megami Tensei, the series, this is not a hard game to play. You know, it's not that level of grindy like Dave has been playing through 3.
Yeah.
And that's like, it takes him a million years to get anywhere in that game.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like that.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah.
Is it engaging to play, if not hard? Like, are all the battles samey when you're grinding, or are there interesting things to engage with as you're going?
Well, because of the weaknesses and everything that you come across, weaknesses and strengths of each of your individual party members, until you get to a certain level of really high above the critters you're fighting, they're actually kind of challenging. So you know, like there's an engaging level of challenge. I'm just playing this on regular mode, whatever the standard mode is, if anybody wants to know. You can change the difficulty down, but if you start in standard mode, you can't go to like hard mode, for example. So, but anyway, also levels tend to be really significant. Once you get a level, it makes a bit like you see like just slight increases on bars and stuff, but then like your actual potency in combat is just exponentially better every single time you gain one level. So if you gain two levels in this, then you are golden. Like you've done a lot. Like you will definitely wipe the floor with whatever you were struggling with a minute ago. You know, that kind of thing.
Nice.
So sometimes I feel like I need to run around and go gain another level or two before progressing the story, but that's partly because I have all the DLC for it as well, and I also am doing like challenge battles against, you know, super difficult demons in the area and things like that, and doing extra side quests. So like I'm keeping myself busy basically going through this. So
makes sense.
Yeah, so this installment of the series includes the moon phase system, which is a standard kind of thing for, I believe, most of these games, where the moon phase affects battle, negotiations with demons for their aid, and also in demon fusion. So, like, you know, there's an optimal moon phase for negotiating, you know, because the demons are in a better mood or whatever, that kind of thing. I don't min-max, so I don't care. I'm just going to play as what is most convenient to me.
I have negative associations with the moon phase thing because of Final Fantasy for the after years. I'm sure they handle it better here, but I immediately recoil when I hear that.
Well, it's a little thing up in the upper part of the screen, and like I will only basically pay attention to it when it comes to, oh, I have to negotiate with this. I need to recruit one of these demons for some fusion I want to do. So
yeah.
I need to, you know, wait until he's in a good mood. And so then I'll, you know, recruit it when it's at that phase or whatever.
Makes sense.
The likelihood increases. So, you know, this game also introduces Magatsuhi skills. So it is a gauge that fills up as you fight, and once it's full you can basically use a super move, and this is a bunch of different types. The first one that you get is called critical, which is pretty obvious what that does. Everything that you do after that for that turn is a critical hit, which also means that you get extra hits as long as you land, you know, as long as your accuracy is high enough to, you know, actually land the blow. So that means you get double the turns. But every demon race also has special Magatsuhi skills that you can unlock by doing side quests throughout the game. Or you can just talk to them out in the world. You can pick them up from some of the like random demons you find just to chit chat with, if I recall correctly. Also, there are Magatsuhi crystals on the active map. Green ones heal your party, yellow ones recover MP, and red ones fill the gauge. So you can also fill the gauge that way. There's also there's a bunch of save points. There's nodes everywhere, or they call them ley lines in this game. And you can actually use like a left trigger and warp back to the last one that you were at automatically, infinitely, as many times as you want to. Also,
that's cool.
You can warp from one of the save points to another save point that you have unlocked. So that's also extremely useful if you are looking for a particular thing, or you want to go back and explore an area, but you don't want to have to run all the way over there. You can just warp around.
Oh, that rules. I mean, it sounds like, not to be a parody of myself, it sounds like a bonfire in and Souls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, also there is an essence system where you can change your elemental affinities or your skills per the skills of the essence in your possession. These essences are tied to each demon. So like you can get an incubus essence or a mermaid essence or whatever. You can also opt to fuse an essence onto one of your demons to give it new skills, but you cannot change its affinity. So like your main character starts out with like a complete immunity to electric, but a weakness to dark or in a couple of, or something else, you know, and you can change that if you are up against a boss that has a bunch of dark skills to like, just basically find one of the essences where there's a shield against dark and then just switch your affinities real quick before that battle. Mm-hmm. You know, and also, again, you can kind of just mix and match skills, not necessarily by fusing demons only, but also by using essences in combination with demons. So, again, this is something that people would probably min-max. Mm-hmm. I don't care to min-max, so that is not my approach.
And you feel like you're getting by, you know, without needing to sweat over every single percentage point.
Yeah, I mean, like, I like to collect the Pokemon. I mm-hmm. like to mash them together and make new Pokemon. I don't care if that Pokemon is the optimal version of itself.
Yeah.
It's fine. I will roll with it. It's just going to get cannibalized and made into something else later in like 5 levels. It doesn't matter. You know?
Nice.
So anyway, you also have miracles, which are special abilities that you unlock using glory, which you accumulate by finding little creatures called Miman that are everywhere in the world as collectibles. Finding them also periodically causes the shopkeeper to reward you. And you can also get glory via special loot D20s that are floating around in the world. I call them D20s. They look like D20s.
Yeah,
they're just like loot boxes.
They're glowing and they... Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, miracles are things like unlocking more summoning slots, improving chances of a demon learning a new skill from a fusion, increasing the Magatsuhi gauge when one or another thing happens during combat, increasing your protag's skill bonuses when they use certain types of attacks, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new ailment called Mirage. They're Hama and Mudo, which are the light and dark skills, now deal regular damage with a chance of insta-kill to enemies that are weak to it. There's also skill potential, which is something that is supposedly like a spiritual successor to some mechanic they brought up in Apocalypse. It applies to the protagonist as well as the demons in this game. This potential influences the cost and the power of each type of skill. So demons have default potentials, but the protagonist is a blank slate and can kind of improve everything using miracle skills that you unlock using glory, which you get by collecting little people. You can also use sutra items to improve skill potential up to +9 for offensive and +5 for supportive skills. So like if you have a demon that you are fusing and like say you are fusing a dark demon out of something that has light skills and then something else, then those light skills, they can still use them, but at like a -4 penalty or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. So that's how the negative side of that works. In the overworld, there are demon statues that will increase ally demons' levels. It cannot increase the protag's level, though. There's also things called abscesses that are obstacles on the map that blot out your vision. It turns it all pink and red.
Gross.
And it spawns a bunch of enemies that you have to destroy. And every time you destroy an abscess, you open up a new path and you also get Magatsuhi and access to new miracles that you can purchase for glory points.
Mm-hmm.
How long to beat puts this game, the main story, at 44 hours, with 61 hours for main plus side stuff and 114 hours for completionist. I am betting I'm going to be somewhere between 61 and 114,
mm-hmm.
Just because I like to explore,
right,
and I like to do side quests, probably more than I care about the main story. So... So that's where I am with this game.
Nice.
The end.
Yeah.
Any questions?
I'm sorry you're disappointed by the main story. And I know that there's no... Maybe all of my assumptions are incorrect. There's no, like, connection between the SMT games other than, like, broad, like, themes and some, like, returning, monsters, you know, Jack Frost and whatnot, right?
that I can tell, this has nothing to do with 4. Now, okay, bear in mind, I have not played the entirety of the SMT series. I played 4. I played 5. That right. is all.
Yeah.
However, I've seen parts of 3, and, you know, just like the whole overdone trope of like the law versus chaos and the good versus the evil and the angels versus the demons. I'm so over it.
Like, right, right.
I don't give a crap. Whatever. And of course, every apocalypse has to happen in Tokyo at fucking Tokyo Tower, whatever. Everybody's going to Tokyo Tower. Yes, we are all going to Tokyo Tower. Where else is there to go?
That's where the world's going to end. Yeah, for sure.
That's where the world's going to end. So, I mean, like, but this one is more, I guess, if within my low tolerance for this subject matter, this is a better iteration of what the same themes and stuff. Like, I actively disliked characters and bits of 4. I do not actively dislike particularly anything in this game. I'm fine with it. I'm just sick of the subject matter. Right, it right. was just funny because I'm actively going after playing these games. That's the whole premise of the fucking game.
Right, but like, right.
Again, it's the Pokemon. It's the Pokemon. That's what I'm here for.
You're there for the designs and the variety. Yeah, no, I get it.
The gameplay, the actual gameplay itself is really what I'm here for. I don't care about the story. I could care less about how you want to shoehorn in the young children in the high school into your organization. I don't care.
Yeah. Yeah. As you know, it's not something I, you know, not to paint with a broad brush, but like broadly, JRPGs tend to cater to people who like something familiar, at least in long yeah. running series, right? There's experimental mm-hmm. stuff going on, just like in any genre, but, you know, you're not going to play a Dragon Quest and, you know, be super satisfied if you're a big fan of that series, if you fire it up and it is anything, you know, too much of a deviation from what you expect.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Like I'm not knocking Shin Megami Tensei for being itself. Let me clarify that.
Why did they make a game about demons?
Like I'm not mad at the game for being itself. Like I said, this is fine. It's just that's, you know, everybody plays games for different reasons and plays them in different ways.
Yeah.
The reason I am in this game is not for that element of the game, which is weird for me because normally if I can't tolerate the story or the characters, then I don't want to get anywhere near that game and I will get immediately angry at the game.
Right.
But this is one of those weird situations where I actually like the play enough that I prefer just like I could care less about the set dressing.
Yeah.
I just want to play the game.
You can play it in wireframe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
huh.
Any other questions about this game before I move on to the other thing?
What's your favorite, what's your favorite monster design that you've seen so far, or demon design?
That's a good question. I don't know. I've kind of like always like the Ippon Datara look so far that I've seen. Like I have a Jack Frost, I have some other stuff. I'm about my character's level is 26, I want to say, something like that. I've got some demons that are a little bit over that, but I summoned them before they got to the higher levels. So,
gotcha.
Yeah, so anyway, like I'm around level 26, so like that's only just so many demons that I've unlocked.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like, I'd have to think about that.
Nothing is stand out as the palm tree that was also a penis. I think was the one that you shared a while back when you were playing 4.
Oh, I don't know. Like, I lost my mind about so many of the designs. Of course, like the only one. Oh, there's what's his name? Well, Incubus, of course, because Incubus has like the big curving, it looks like a blade strap on
yep.
thing between
Jimmy Lust from 7. Yeah
so that kind of a deal. I don't know, like it's kind of like I cannot pronounce the name of it, but there is a Philippine, female demon from the Philippines that is, I think it's Manananggal or something like that. She's really, like, for me, part of my interest is which of these demons is the horniest. And I think she's currently the horniest demon possible. She's cut into two pieces with her guts hanging out, but her upper half is floating, and all of her is naked, and she's touching her own ass, and she's chasing a Jack Frost with weird, saying weird implications and things that, like, the Jack Frost is like, save me from her, and that's how you first meet that demon.
Wow.
So anyway, it's bad. And like, it's so weird because I so often just eye roll and just go, oh, this is just super horned out. What the hell? But like, it's, I guess it's because the way that it's played up in these games, and it's just all the demons are just nuts.
Yeah.
It's just, no, they're all weird. And like, it just kind of, the main character's not weird. He's not being weird to anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
It's none of the other characters. They're all straight laced. It's just the demons.
Yeah.
It's its own little weird thing where it's just like, it's kind of like watching a train wreck and you're like, wow, they put that in there.
The demons are all pulled from the Dragon's Crown universe.
Demons are role models. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, like, you know, okay, they can justify it because they're demons and, you know, whatever. So,
anyway. For as shitty as, you know, I'll pull something from my own life. For as shitty as the Saw movies are, there's still a little bit of joy in watching the stupid creative traps, right? Like, oh, what are they going to pull?
Yeah.
What are they going to do this time? Right? No,
And it's like, it gets to the point where it's just funny. Like, every time I see something like this, I like Manananggal, or however you pronounce her name, there's a lot of A's and N's. It's funny. Mm-hmm. It's just funny the degree that they've got it turned up. And
yeah.
So anyway, I will stop talking about that.
And if the play is on point, then yeah, no, that's, I get it.
I will definitely take, you know, like, sit there and take screenshots and wait for Dave if he's not there and be like, Dave, look at this one. Look what this one did. This is ridiculous. So
nice.
Okay. All right. Other game. So AI, the Somnium Files.
Oh, that's by Zero Escape guy, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And I've got something funny to tell you. I did not really follow the game release news, and I didn't even know this game existed until a couple of weeks ago when I stumbled across it on the eStore.
Uh-huh.
And I also had no idea that it was a Spike Chunsoft game until after I booted it up, because I don't pay attention to Jack or shit. So I was like, oh, that looks like an interesting game. It's something that I could play because I don't want to play Twitchy Metroid right now. And so I just want something that's not Shin Megami Tensei to play sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, when I loaded it up, I was digging the cyber noir setting. I was 1,000% prepared in my soul for a gritty noir crime in like a near future kind of game. And then
up crawls, hello, I wrote Virtue's yes. Last Reward.
Yeah.
How would you be interested in this Wikipedia article that I found?
So I'll talk about it. I'll put a pin in that right now. So, all right. From the top, Spike Chunsoft murder mystery adventure game, published in 2019, sequel coming out next year. Okay. Written and directed by the guy who wrote and direct Zero Escape series. Bear in mind, with Zero Escape, I liked 999. I was fine with Zero Time Dilemma. It's just VLR that I didn't really dig. Like, it just sent me over the edge. And
right.
It's mostly because the main character. Now, here's the problem. The main character in this game gives me real VLR vibes.
Oh, no. And the main character in VLR, Sigma, I mean, horny, right? Like, just says inappropriate things and, you know, just at the wrong time, like incongruously so. And people react to him doing that. And there's a reason why they react the way they do. But it is really drawn attention to.
So yeah, like the first time you end up in the dream sequences, you're talking to the AI that is in your eye socket eyeball. Okay. And she is your avatar in the dream world. And then he's like, so I can do whatever I want with you in here. And that's like one of the first things that you hear him talk. He's like, ew, gross.
Hey,
no,
hey, dude, can you not?
God. Yeah. Like, so that crap started up real early in the game. Okay. I'm going to back up a little bit. I need to, I'll rant about that. Okay. Let me talk about the game aside from my impressions of it. Okay. There's Easter eggs in the game that indicate that it's set in the same universe as Danganronpa.
Okay.
The puzzles in the game are intentionally less difficult than the ones in the Zero Escape series. The writer and director said that he modeled it basically as a modern take on Hideo Kojima's Police Knots kind of puzzles.
Okay.
Other influences included Eve, The Silver Case, Life is Strange, Detroit Become Human, Heavy Rain, and The Walking Dead.
Okay.
So that's a bunch of reference points. So in the story, let me talk about that before I get mad. you play as Kaname Date, who is a cop in near future Tokyo working with Abyss, Abyss is the way that they pronounce it, the Advanced Brain Investigation Squad. You are a sinker, someone who can enter dreams of a witness or a suspect and unlock subconscious memories and information to help crack cases when somebody is too traumatized to speak or physically in a coma, or maybe they just don't want to tell you, but we're going to take the information out of your head anyway.
Okay.
So that's the setup. Date conveniently lost all of his memories 6 years ago when he also lost his left eye. It was replaced with an AI eyeball. Which is Iba. They transcribe it as Iba, but mm-hmm. They're saying eyeball.
Oh, so, yeah.
Anyway, eyeball can communicate wordlessly with Date via an artificial nerve and also gives him night vision, x-ray vision, and a zoom function. So this sounds like a pretty cool setup.
Sounds like
she can also she pops out of Date's head and kind of makes a gel body of a bear. And then walks around and talks to other people, including like your boss and stuff. Yes, a bear. Here, I will show you. There's a video. That's a video. That's just a screenshot for that one. Sorry. Yeah. There is a video. I think so. On my Twitter, you can scroll around and find it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's a thing. And as I mentioned, in the dream sections of the game, Date is replaced with a humanoid version of Eyeball, who acts as the player's avatar. And they actually try to explain why. I didn't pay attention, but anyway, there's no reason. You can read about it. I posted the thing on the Twitter. You can go look. So at the start of the game, Date is summoned to a crime scene where a woman was murdered and tied to a merry-go-round horse in an abandoned sector of town, and her left eye is gouged out.
Mm.
At the scene, he stumbles across the woman's daughter trapped inside the column of the ride, holding an ice pick that happened to gouge out that woman's eye.
Okay.
And so his mission is to figure out who did it, why, what's going on. The girl is mute and can't talk when you first see her, and you have to actually go through a whole somnium section to see if you can heal her psychic trauma to help her get back to being able to speak again so she can tell you what the hell's going on. So, the gameplay. The average play time for this is allegedly 20 to 25 hours, so I don't believe this is going to overstay its welcome, nor do I think the pacing is going to go awry given its pedigree, because as much as it frustrated me, the pacing in the prior games was fine. Like all the other games from this publisher, developer, writer, whatever, you know, like the pacing is not a problem. Also, the flowchart setup where you can skip to decision points rather than replaying the whole thing to get there. You can fast forward. You can skip parts that you've already seen. All of these are things I want in every single game of this style.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
This game has all of those.
Bare minimum.
Concessions. Yeah. So, like, that is in its favor. So the gameplay is divided between investigation and somnium cycles, with branching paths leading to multiple endings. And of course, to get the true ending, you have to finish all of the other endings first. The investigation is really self-explanatory. Those are the longer segments of the game. And then the somnium sections tend to be pivotal points where the paths branch, at least from what I've seen so far. I've only hit a couple of somnium sections. You have a limited amount of time in the dream world. You have 6 minutes, after which you need to be gone, or else your personality or the host's body might be damaged or lost for unexplained reasons. You do not burn time unless Eyeball is moving around and doing stuff, though, so it's not as high pressure as that sounds. You can kind of look around and kind of figure out what you want to do before you burn all your time up.
Yeah.
Plus, you get things that are called timies, which is an acronym that is explained briefly and I don't pay attention. Whatever.
Of course it is. Yeah,
it's a bonus that lowers the amount of time it takes to perform actions in Somnium. Mm-hmm. So there's also a rewind feature. So you get to backtrack up to 3 different movements that take time in the world. And if you fail the section without coming to one or another of the branching paths, you can just restart the Somnium segment without redoing any of the stuff that happened before it. And once you've played through a particular course of actions, there are green and white check marks next to those actions so you remember what you did the next time you go to play that
part. Oh, that's good. Yeah.
So all of that is great. Like, those are all good concessions to gameplay that I think were solid decisions. So you have to interact with elements in the dream world in different ways, not always ways that make sense, in order to unlock clues. You use these clues to open mental locks, and those feel like they are lifted straight out of Ace Attorney, with only a few differences. And like, I've uploaded video of examples of like the puzzles and the mental locks. You can take a look at
those. It's not real subtle.
No. So initially this felt like it was leaning really, really heavily into Ace Attorney territory, because it's a murder mystery where you're trying to figure out who done it, but all the main characters are just weird as hell. Mm-hmm. Only the way they're weird is just really off-putting rather than fitting into an overall goofy tone like Ace Attorney does.
Right.
So there's super dissonance, especially at first, which has lessened a little bit, but it still feels off where I'm at in the game right now. Like, there's just weird crap that I cannot, like, I'm just like, what is happening and why is it happening? Why are you doing a weird dance when you first pop up? Why are you cheering like a goober? Like, what the weird thing about Date is that he is really serious and everything in his physical presentation to everybody else in the world.
Okay.
But when he is inside his head / dream world, like if he's talking to Aiba directly, or if he's in, you know, Insomnium with her or something, then he's just completely weird, like real weird. So anyway, I was having real trouble trying to get a handle on what this game was trying to do. And Dave's been watching me play, and the way that he described this is like watching Blade Runner, but somebody put Pee Wee Herman in there.
Duh.
And that is absolutely an apt description of how it feels to play the beginning of this game.
Yeah.
And if I recall correctly, that goofiness with the perviness were my biggest problems with Virtue / Reward, along with just how many false endings I had to sit through without as many quality of life concessions. Like, I had to be, you know, replay a bunch of shit in that game.
Yeah.
So it's triggering some of those VLR feels, but since the quality of life concessions exist in this game, the perviness is not as bad as VLR, at least not so far. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that I will find this more palatable overall. I'm between somewhere in the 5 to 10 hours of play range, and I have not gotten angry at it yet. Mostly I'm just kind of staring at, like, what are you doing? Or, ew, that's gross. Like, why? Mm-hmm. You know,
this is describing then, like, Spike Chunsoft games in general. Yes.
Yeah. And then, but then I'm like, I've developed a theory about the main character that, if it's correct, explains all the cryptic stuff everybody is half saying, and also explains a variety of other details, including the disparate nature of his personality.
Mm-hmm.
And so, since this is Spike Chunsoft, though, I fully expect the truth to be way more complicated than I'm already theorizing. But, like, I had replied to Eric on Twitter about this. So if anybody wants to see my theory, it's like in a string off of one of the things I posted from this game so recently. So that would be 12.5 or 12.6, one of those days, if anybody wants to go back and look at my theory. But anyway, it's probably going to get super ridiculous, and I'm fine with that. That's cool.
Yeah.
I will say the voice acting, the animations, all of that stuff is all really good. The gameplay is fine. Like, it's not frustrating to go through the Somnium parts. They have so many ease of use, you know, concessions in there that it's fine. Mm-hmm. Like, there's not a problem going through the game. It's not like you have to bang your head against the assembling the comics at the end of the Danganronpa trial or, you know, something like that. You know, like, it's not that weird and hard to play. So anyway, like, I'm looking forward to seeing more of the actual story, because the actual base story I'm interested in, and, you know, like, various other elements. It's just that weird, disparate nature of the main character being like he is that I'm like
this,
all right,
this tone feels sloppy, guys. Yeah.
We're here again, are we?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any questions?
I mean, it's nice. So when I had heard about this, you know, people saying like, yeah, it's, you know, if you liked the Room Escape stuff and Zero Escape, this might be disappointing because it's, you know, a little bit more, it's on the visual novel side of things. I'm surprised to hear that there's as much play as there is. Like, you make the Somnium, you know, dream diving stuff sound tense and cool. So that seems kind of neat. Like, you know, are the people who describe it as being basically just a visual novel, are they correct, or is it, you know, or were they being oversimplifying it?
I would say that that's more on the correct side than incorrect, because the investigation sections are basically the visual novel parts,
right?
And that is the bulk of the game. The Somnium sections are limited. You have a certain number of moves you can even perform throughout those segments, and they are short by comparison to, you know, they are meaningful. That is where your pivot points, but that's also short sections.
Yeah.
So it's more on the visual novel side than it is on anything else. It was intended for a more of an adventure game kind of audience anyway. So, you know, it more so than people who want like super active play.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I don't have any other questions about it. I'm happy to hear somebody who I know talk about it, because I you know your reactions to the other stuff. That's kind of in the genre.
Well, and then too, this is like, okay, it's a Spike Chunsoft title. Everyone grab onto something and hold on, because we don't know what she's going to say about this.
Well, I mean,
because it runs the gamut, right? Because I really, really enjoy parts of basically all of them. Even VLR, I liked stuff about it. That's why I was playing it. But like, I also got mad. I got mad.
Right, right.
So I had no tolerance. And like, I don't know if my tolerance is just higher now, or, you know, like, I already know what to expect to a certain degree.
That
with
was
this
also
one.
A while ago. You know?
Yeah, also, a long time ago. So yeah. I mean, like, yeah. But the scars remain cold.
I just said, I'm picturing your face when you saw the Spike Chunsoft logo come up.
Yeah, I was just like, oh God. Oh man. I didn't even realize, but like, you know, there's something about this company where they still make a good game, and I still ended up on the like side of all of their games, but like, maybe hostily, but I was there for all of them.
I mean, it speaks well that you're curious about the mystery, you know. That is ultimately kind of what is important about these, you know.
Oh yeah,
and it's still kind of tantalizing you, you know. Drawing
well,
you forward.
This is it feels like it's more simplified than the kind of bug nuts crap he came up with for Zeroscape, because Zeroscape was all over the board, and I still don't know if I have 100% clear vision of what the hell was going on exactly, because he just introduced so many random bits, mm-hmm. you know, and themes that he rolled with for a while, and I'm not sure if they actually were real, you know,
like, right.
You know, but this one is doesn't have that many layers, so it's a lot more simplified in a lot of ways.
Nice.
So
cool.
Yeah. The end.
I've got one. It's new.
Yay.
I have been playing and also streamed a little bit of this. It is a strategy game. It is a survival city builder called End Zone: A World Apart.
So sports game, right?
Yep. It is all about the football, baby, the gridiron, the big game. It is a German developer, so I'm not sure if they are aware of the meaning that End Zone has over here, regarding, you know, football and stuff like that. But it is a game you play as, you know, somebody who is leading a colony trying to restart a civilization after a nuclear apocalypse. So this is a, you know, post-apocalyptic city builder kind of deal, where you are dealing with managing a growing population with dwindling supplies. And also
so the population soon becomes supplies.
There is no decree that I've seen so far where you can turn population into supplies, but you got what I was going towards. I was going to say with there's a weather system where you really need to prepare for inclement events coming down. It feels very similar to Frostpunk, you know,
Fallout Punk.
Yeah. And it's good. I really am enjoying it. You know, obviously this is a game that scratches a particular kind of itch for me. But it is really satisfying to play this. And I've had fun, you know, on stream kind of talking through the decision-making process and planning a few moves ahead and kind of thinking of, okay, anticipating bottlenecks and where things are going to pop up, you know. So you're doing all the usual stuff. You have to plant, you know, you're dealing with water. You've got to find food. You need to get, wood and scrap, and then scrap can be converted into all kinds of like subsidiary resources. So like plastic, metal, and those can be fortified into a whole bunch of different things, all kinds of supply chains and things like that. And then I already mentioned food, but those are your big, your big things. And, you design your workforce by allocating people to particular jobs. There are a huge number of moving parts in this. This is, feels like an order of magnitude more complex than Frostpunk, which I don't think is completely to its benefit, you know?
Yeah. It looks super daunting from what I saw with this. It's like, oh, dozens of buildings you can build. Yeah, looks scary.
It's a bunch. Yeah, you know, and each of the buildings, you know, it's not just like you've got certain people dedicated to like, okay, your food workers, you know, you like, okay, so we have this number of fishermen, we have this number of gatherers, we have this number of hunters, we have this number of farmers, you know, etc. But when you allocate people for a certain job, they're going to go and, you know, go and work that. And like the big inclement weather thing. So in Frostpunk, it's the blizzards, right? You know, that changes your because you're managing the heat level, right? If the heat goes down low, people start dying and you have to prepare and stock up because people can't work outside. Here, the big thing is not really radiation, although that factors in. The big thing is droughts, actually. So you're not getting like, you know, rad storms or whatever, like you get in Fallout, but like you get a, you know, a season or two of drought and all of a sudden you're drawing down on your water and maybe you're pulling from polluted water sources. You're not growing food at this point. And if you're relying on fishing for food, then all of a sudden, you know, that is literally dried up, et cetera. So like you need to anticipate these things coming down and have enough of a buffer so that you can go into survival mode when those things come up. And like you can research like down the tech tree to build build weather stations to increase your forecasting, you know, to see when these are going to come to help your planning. And then after the droughts, occasionally there will be sandstorms, which whip up and do damage to your to your buildings. So you gotta, you know, have building workforce ready not only to clear the radiation but to repair everything. So it's all like exercises and planning and making sure that your, you know, reach doesn't that your reach doesn't exceed your grasp. There we go. I always get that backwards.
The ant and the grasshopper, the game.
kinda, yeah. You know, and it makes a big point and says, you really don't want to have your population grow too fast. And it's like, oh, but I keep on hitting a ceiling with workers, you know, like if only I had like four or five more people. And it's like, no, do not build any more cabins. Because if those people start fucking, we're all done for. That can't be a title.
it's the first promotion in Papers, Please, just as the eternal conundrum.
I mean, kinda, but like, whew. I mean, it diversifies for like housing. So, you know, there's general like shelters which can house a bunch of people, but there's no privacy, so no people are made. And you've got cabins, you know, privacy. Houses with privacy. The more of those you have, the more your population will grow. And when a new person is born, you know, people stay kids and they can't work again because this is not playing in the same it's not playing in the same space as Frostpunk entirely, so you can't do child labor. Instead, you know, that is a time where like different new generations can be more educated because you can research school and stuff. And they become, and depending on what you research in your school, they can come out, better at particular tasks. Right. But they're still a resource draw, when they're young. So if you get this immediate boom, you're dealing with just a huge drain, you know? So, that is the case where if you are running like the grasshopper, or I guess more appropriately like the hare, and reproducing like crazy, then you're gonna have some issues. Trying to think of what else. Something that's real cool. Again, this is a super like finicky, and it's a level of complexity that's not going to be for everybody. But logistics in this really matter. So like when your dudes harvest something, it's not like they go and pick it up and it immediately goes into the big inventory that everybody can draw from. Where that ends up and like the steps that it takes to get where it needs to go is actually super important. So they need to if they're harvesting far out from the base, they need to walk it back to, you know, the closest storage point. When somebody needs it, they're going to have to go and get it. And so you can set up like a network of temporary storehouses and warehouses and stuff and set people to work in logistics to run things back and forth. So everything will be near where it needs to be. You know, it's handled automatically, but you need to, you know, research that and dedicate the people there. And it's real interesting because like when you click on a building that is doing a task, you can see like the path that everybody needs to walk in order to make the task happen. And then you can use that as your as like a basis for figuring out how to lay things out. Like maybe I need to have this intermediate step right here because they're having to, you know, walk all across creation to get this thing. It's neat. Like I don't know, I feel like I'm describing a nightmare, but it's actually fun and good.
God help me enjoy one thing as much as Cole enjoys optimization.
Difficulty?
perhaps.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, there's some charming like Eurojank to this. Like, the localization isn't entirely good, and it's, you know, there's some weird like clanging stuff. So I'm playing it with the with the expansion here. Just like about 2 months ago, they released the it's like the Prosperity expansion or something like that, which is like, okay, you move just beyond just surviving, you can start building like comfortable things. Like, you can start making a pub and, you know, researching creature comforts and stuff, which is a real neat way for it to go. But it's like, as part of that, you look at the tech tree and then you see, you know, down at the far end, like, oh, you can grow pot, which is weird, but it makes sense because, you know, if you're, you know, as opposed to eventually you're going to run out of scrap to harvest cloth from, right? To refine cloth from. So you're going to grow hemp. And as a part of getting hemp, you know, hemp is the male plant and cannabis is the female plant, I believe. And you're going to have that. And if you're going to make alcohol, you might as well have pot too. And, you know,
oh, look, somebody's going to grow it. You might as well grow it and tax it, right?
I think ideologically I would be opposed to a prohibition against pot, especially. I mean, the stuff's hard. Let them get high. Come on. So like there's some stuff that's kind of like, huh, okay, didn't expect that, but I can deal with it. It's ultimately just another thing to manage because it changes contentedness, and contentedness changes their efficiency as they're working, and, you know, makes them better, you know, better fits for the jobs that they're in and stuff like that, and makes them more likely to reproduce. They move faster. All these things are, you know, taken into consideration. So like, yeah, I would want to let them do whatever they needed to be happy, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I feel like I just kind of spouted off about this city builder. It's real good. And true to form, like with any of these, I'm finding myself needing to fight the urge to play it when I know I have other things that I need to play. Any questions?
Sign of a good game right there.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Any questions about Endzone?
Nope. Let me know when you discover how to build cocaine.
I have not seen cocaine. I think you grow the coca leaves and then you refine it into cocaine. And then you cut it for distribution, etc. But I have not seen cocaine on the tech tree. I don't think you're dealing with that.
Mistake.
It unlocks when you discover a new New York.
Oh man, that's all I've got. I mean I've done a smattering of other things, but nothing in depth like that. So
cool.
Yeah. Dennis, how about you?
Yeah, I've just got a little one. So we try to do like one-on-one time with the kids, and we'll do a quote unquote date with them. Oh. So it was my turn to do that with Luke, and we went out to a restaurant. He's decided he likes Red Lobster.
Okay.
I don't know why.
Awesome. Those biscuits. Come on, man.
Cheddar biscuits are there. Yeah. And then he gets mac and cheese, and I feel defeated for going to a seafood restaurant for mac and cheese, but at least get the lobster mac and cheese. Anyway. But they've got those little like auto pay consoles at the table that have a little video screen and are constantly showing ads for basically you pay $5 to play a round of match three crap, right?
Right.
And he's of course very interested in it. I'm like, you don't need to pay for that. I can just download something on my phone.
Yeah.
I was like, I wonder what good two player like local multiplayer iPhone games are out there. Mm-hmm. And very quickly found a blast from my past, Pocket Tanks.
Pocket Tanks. And
I don't know if it was that specific name, but we've all played this game. It's two little tanks on deformable, randomly generated terrain. You pick the angle and the power and just take turns lobbing shots at each other. And every shot will either hit the tank or blast apart the terrain in a way that might move the tank.
This is
does that sound familiar?
Yeah, this it's like Worms. Side view, you're setting the trajectory. Yeah, this is similar to Worms, or there was another name. It was like Annihilation or something kind of generic for like the old PC version.
There's a zillion of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is the perfect game to play while you're just hanging out at a restaurant across the table from each other.
Or you just pass it back and forth.
Exactly. And it was a blast. Haha, get it. But the little wrinkle on Pocket Tanks, which was the app I found, was you draft your weapons. So they've got a list of 20 weapons, and you go back and forth, each person picking one until they're all chosen. And every shot is a different weapon. So you can never completely settle in and be like, aha, I found the angle. Now I just stay here and blast away.
Right.
Because each weapon might do something a little different. One might be like a spread fire. One might be a hyper precise missile, et cetera. And that was the real fun is each time someone went, you read the name of the new weapon and then you see what it does. And so it's like, oh, the firecracker or, the dirt mover or, you know, the worm one was called in a nice little throwback. And they all have, you know, crazy effects. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was just, you know, a simple game, but as just a little time waster, like I would play that with anyone I was sitting at a restaurant with. It was so much fun. And the nice thing was if you didn't feel like, you know, doing a draft of all the weapons, which we didn't really understand what anything did because we had just downloaded the game. There's a quick pick and it just randomly assigns 10 to each.
Yeah.
So played a little, Pocket Tanks game that was fun. It's going to stay on my phone. That'll be a little time waster whenever we're out and about and, need to kill some time.
Yeah. Scorched Earth is the one that I'm familiar with that I'm thinking about. That was like a 90s like shareware version of this.
Very cool.
Yeah.
The one fun story is there's an, I think it's called the Ion Cannon was the weapon. And basically you launch a beacon and wherever the beacon lands, a giant ion beam fires down and does damage, but also like digs a hole straight to the ground. So Luke hit me with one and then I miraculously hit him with one from my hole in the middle of the dirt. And so we're both just like at the bottom of these pits that are like completely vertical shafts that you have to be at like a 1 or 2 degree angle to fire.
Yeah.
And of course, if you get something down in it, then you're guaranteed to hit. And so the rest of the game was just trying to adjust for that.
Trying not to accidentally shoot yourself.
Exactly. Yeah, have something fall back down on you or collide with the side. It was a good time.
Oh, that sounds that sounds like a good time.
Mm-hmm. That's the new game that I've been playing. Lots and lots of map building in Trackmania. So Trackmania is primarily like a European game. It's got a way bigger fan base, specifically in France, because the company that makes it is out there. But in general, just it's not as big in North America. But they're starting to have a little more traction, and so they're hosting a North American Open tournament that kind of mirrors the Grand Open League that they do, which I guess is global, but all the time slots are European times. And so I've been making and submitting maps for that, and we'll see if anything gets through. I am definitely not talented enough to race in the tournament, or at least do well in the tournament. but I'm really proud of these maps that I've done, and we'll see if anything makes it in. So nice. I'll be very excited if that happens.
Fingers crossed for you.
Mm-hmm. So that's what I've been playing.
Cool.
I am approaching, let me check real quick just to be sure. I'm at 731 hours in Trackmania. Wow. After, and it was right, so 731 hours in a single year I've put in.
So you'd say you got your money's worth.
Of my time I've played. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
So you'd say you got your money's worth.
I think so, you know?
Nice.
But I'm going to do the very depressing math. I'm just now thinking of this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, don't do that. Don't do the math.
Let's see, 731 math. See if you can beat me, Ben. See if you can beat me.
I don't know what the problem is.
How many full days? So yeah. I've spent 30 days of playtime. Oh wow, Is that right? Yeah, yep. I guess 731 hours, which divided by 365.
Yeah,
I spent 8% of my life in the last year playing Trackmania. Holy crap!
I mean, it's it's better than doing a month of I don't know,
heroin.
Yeah, and name your illicit substance.
You Red know? Lobster. No.
Yeah, it's better than doing a month of Cheddar Bay biscuits. As tempting as it is,
riding the crawfish.
Oh man.
Oh yeah. Well, I know some of that is leading the game up and it has been a little over a year, but yeah, I absolutely have gotten my money's worth out of that game.
Nice.
That's me.
Ben.
I got a bunch of tiny updates, nothing terribly new. Storybook Brawl, I played a bunch of over the weekend. There was a reset between last week and this week. So I guess they're doing that every month, is they'll reset people's ranks to 3,000.
Okay.
If they were above that. And then whoever places 4,000 or above gets invited to like their season tournament, I think.
Okay.
So I've been grinding that. I got to like maybe 3,600, 3,700, but I was ranked 250, so I was pretty happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if that means that I'm getting better or if less people are playing the game. But it's one of those two things. But it's good. They're going to put out a patch for it, I think, in a week or two. But it's still the same. It's been the same for like the last couple weeks. So the meta hasn't really changed or anything. So that's all I got to say about that. I've been playing Gloomhaven as well. I have like three different campaigns going on at the same time. So I'm playing with the people that I played it with the physical game, which are my friends in Austin. Mm-hmm. I'm playing it with some computer science people from Cincinnati. And then I'm just playing my own campaign when I want to play and there's no one around. Mm-hmm. Then like progressing through. So it's still fun, but it's getting confusing now because it's like I forget which classes are unlocked in which campaign.
Right.
And, like which missions we've done in which campaigns. So, and then if I replay, there's like, in particular, like this week, there were like maybe two or three missions I had replayed for a second time. So I have to kind of like shut up and not say anything of like what the twist is or anything in the mission to not try and ruin the surprise.
Mm-hmm. They have a lot of missions where it's like, you know, read this text when you land on space C, which is towards the end. And so a lot of missions are designed around and then, you know, it's a mad scramble or you get inundated with enemies or what have you. So yeah, I could see that being really hard to withhold your knowledge when you know it's going to upend what everyone is planning.
Like, oh, I can save us so much grief. Yeah.
Even on the vanilla maps, just knowing what's on the other side of a door, a lot of information, I guess. It's like where the enemies are and what their attacks are. Anyway, it's still fun. I think I can't remember where I was at a week or two ago when I talked about it, but I know I've unlocked like maybe two or three classes in the past 2 weeks. So it's been interesting to play with new ones. There's one class that is unlocked on Austin group's campaign where it's like the character you can get if you do the options. I think I mentioned this last week.
Yeah,
it looks really sweet, but I still haven't gotten a chance to play that yet. But mm-hmm. I want to try and unlock that or like retire so I can play as that character.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So that's all I got with Gloomhaven. And then the last game I've been playing is Spiritfarer, which I talked about a week or two ago.
Yeah.
So that's the beautifully animated game where you are playing as, I forget the pronunciation, but Charon?
Yeah, Charon.
Death.
Yeah.
Death boat person.
The ferryman across the river Styx.
Yeah. I've continued playing that. I think I've kind of like unlocked more of like the building space and more of like the, I guess, like functions. It's not like end zone where it's like you get everything in front, like they kind of slow roll, like here's a new building, here's what you can do with it, like here's what kind of resource it can produce.
Okay.
And they kind of roll it out like one by one. Each building's usually associated with one of the characters that you're ferrying to the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll usually be passionate about whatever it is. So like one example is there's like a building, like a loom. And so one of the characters will show you like how to make like thread out of something that's not thread. And then how to make linen out of that eventually. It's mm-hmm. like the buildings will have like kind of like an upgrade to it as well. You can like pay to upgrade the buildings so they can do more advanced things.
Mm-hmm.
So I've kind of unlocked some of that stuff. I think I have like maybe 6 characters on my boat somewhere in that neighborhood. I'm not sure how many total there are. And I finally, this last week, took my first character to the afterlife, and they like passed on.
Okay.
And that's kind of like the selling point of the game, where it's like the, you know, it's supposed to be these kind of like emotional like parting of ways, and it hit a really good emotional note. The one part that was funny is like it like lingers on this scene where it like it pans up to like a star constellation. You see a constellation representing the character, and it's like very moody, and like you feel it, you know. And then it flashes pressy, like on the bottom of the screen. It's like, oh yeah, that's right. I'm playing a game. Okay,
right.
Sure, yeah.
The game's just kind of like, not to interrupt you here, but
yeah. So there's anyway, but it's still a charming game. There, a few of the mechanics could be a little bit improved. You're doing like a lot of like doubling back on the map. So basically there's like a map room that you have on your ship where you can go, and it gives you like a 2D map of the world that you're on. And mm-hmm. it has like a fog of war effect, and there's kind of barriers that you can overcome if you upgrade your ship correctly. But on the given like space that you've unlocked and the given like kind of locations, you can see like what's on each of the islands. And to their credit, like as resources refresh on the islands, it's shown on the map. So it kind of makes it easy to like, okay, I need like iron ore. I'm going to go back to this place because they have it now. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. But sometimes there's a lot of back and forth. Like to upgrade your ship, you have to go to one specific spot. If you wanted to get like a sheep or something or one particular resource, you might have to go on the other end of the map. And so sometimes it's a little bit annoying because you have a lot of dead time where you're just on your ship, mm-hmm. and it kind of shows like a progress meter of like how long it's taking. There are some cool effects with that where if you're passing by different landmarks, like you're not heading there, but you're just like on a line traveling to a different one and you're passing near something, it'll render it in the background, like with kind of like an appropriate distance of how far away you are from it. Mm-hmm. So it feels like a nice, like kind of like, fully formed like world, you know, or it's like it doesn't feel like a completely empty space or anything.
Yeah.
But the fact that you're doubling back so much kind of gets a little bit annoying at times if you don't have any other like chores to do. So
yeah. When you send somebody on to the other mm-hmm. side, does the building that is associated with them, like, does that go away, or does it gain like a permanent buff? Like, how do they handle that?
Yeah, so they have a couple buildings associated. They have like room or that produces some sort of resource. That stays how it is. There's not really any change to that. Mm-hmm. But then they have like, you can build like personal rooms for all their characters, and and you can even upgrade those. So it's kind of like Sim style, where it's like you can put a dresser here, you can put a carpet here, you can put a picture here, like that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's usually minimal. It's like 3 different upgrades per building.
Yeah.
But that's left there. You don't like deconstruct it or anything. And I think that it's kind of like a more or less like a shrine is there as far as like a remembrance for them, you know,
if you
walk into it. So it's kind of, I don't know, looks like a nice way to, I don't know. Yeah. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can deconstruct it. I would have to look to see if I would do that. I'm not going to, unless I like am in dire need of space or something like that.
Right. I mean, unless the game forced you to like move on, it seems like it would be, counter to the theming.
Yeah. And the art style is really cool. The like the place where you like they pass on the after, kind of like Japanese like stone bridge, mm-hmm. where it's like a semicircle like underneath it, if that makes sense. So with like the reflection of the water, it's like a complete circle that they pass through.
Oh, nice.
It's just, I don't know. Yeah, the art style is really nice. So
yeah.
So that's it's still like a pretty game, an enjoyable game. It's going to be, you know, the best game ever, like the best game of the year, but not a bad way to pass the time. So
yeah, it sounds pleasant. And the key word there is cozy. That is the buzzword for that kind of game. Yeah.
Yep. Nice. That's all I got.
Storybook Brawl Gloomhaven Spiritfarer.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's a title. And I don't mean that's the title, like, let's make that the title of the podcast. I just mean as one word.
Yep.
That's what it sounded like.
Yeah. I did run those together. Oh.
It was very good, Cole.
Multiplayer.
Now it's time for the multiplayer, where we ask you a question and then you answer it. I believe this was you, Dennis.
That is correct.
Question mark? What's the question you ask the nice people?
I use an XCOM picture. Of course it's me. So it's all about randomness, mm-hmm. which can be a divisive mechanic, but can also be a lot of fun. So what games make the best or most creative use of RNG?
Yeah. I'll get us started here with Greg, who says the Fallout games, I thought had a very consistent and fair random number generator. Unlike, say, XCOM, the issue with that is proven in your picks, used an XCOM accuracy meme as the picture for the post. Unlike, say, XCOM, it seems how the games generate the percent is correct based on all of the factors at play. And usually, if you fail, there's no harsh punishment for failing. So it cuts down on reloading tries to get the end result that you know that you're entitled to. Spoken like somebody who has never accidentally iced their whole party on a bad on a critical miss, which can happen in a Fallout game. If Greg is speaking of the earlier tactical Fallout games.
Yeah. Although there to me anyway, it felt like there were less instances of like, okay, that just feel like that percentage should not be there. Like there's definitely the moments of like, oh, I should have hit that and I didn't. Mm-hmm. But less instances where you feel like the assigned percentage chance doesn't match up with at least what you feel like it would be in that actual situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Jala, what does Jeremy say?
Says, I think a game like Diablo or Minecraft does a really good job at random generating the dungeon or world. Always fun finding a new building or a mine shaft when you are exploring or mining. It keeps the game exciting.
Yeah. It's always fun when you're digging into a big mountain and you break through into a whole network of, you know, like a stronghold. Or you know, an actual like mine shaft, although those do come with spiders that'll mess you up anyway.
Mm-hmm. that is so impressive to be able to do RNG for an entire world. Like any of those mm-hmm. randomly generated world games, just for the most part, the you know the level of cool stuff that they can get in while still having it created by an algorithm is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's and that the fact that the generation has kind of only gotten better, you know, I mean, I haven't played Minecraft in several years now, but even over the time that I was, you know, dipping into and out of it, it would. The randomization, it felt less glitchy and disjointed. Biomes made just a little bit more sense.
Yeah. Ironically, by making it slightly less random.
Yeah, I mean, that's the good thing. Right.
You know what? There is a reverse uncanny valley for randomness.
Yeah. No. Go on.
So that, you know, actually random is actually not fun. You need just that little bit of curated to really spike the fun and get the most out of it. And then it kind of falls off as things get less and less random.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is definitely a fine science. You know, and mm-hmm. also how random it is versus how random you are consciously led to believe, you know?
Sure. Yes. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Ben, what does Alex say?
Alex says Zero Time Dilemma had RNG plot. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Had RNG built into the plot. Yeah. It just get you kind of cut out there and rather than having to do it again. It. Yeah. no, I forget. Jala, you played Zero Time Dilemma more recently than me.
I've blotted it out of my brain.
Yeah.
No, I honestly don't remember. I was trying to actually think about it, but I
it could be that you basically have to choose your doors at random to start, right? Like the sequence you see things in is pretty. Actually, I don't remember well enough to say if that was the case or not. That's my guess at where it is.
It's been a minute since any of us have played it.
Yeah.
So I don't
those games concern themselves with multiverse stuff, which almost always plays into probability, so that mm-hmm. likely is what Alex is saying by it factoring into the plot. Yeah. Jala, what does David say?
David says, which Pokemon shows up in random battles is a pretty cool use of RNG. I know it's not that different from other JRPG random battles, but the fact that you're trying to catch them makes it an awesome surprise when a cool one pops up.
Yeah. Especially if you're in a new area. Makes sense to me. Yeah. Dennis, what does the other David say?
The other David says, not a good use, but the one time RNG went my way, the original Destiny in the weeks before taking King, I lucked into a hand cannon where one of the first three shots were auto crits and the final shot was an auto crit. It had five rounds. I'm not much of an online gamer, but this thing had me running around the Crucible looking like John Wick. Yes, I can't remember the name, but I do remember the five-round burst rifle that... Or no, this is a hand cannon. Huh. I remember reading about five-round bursts being OP, so...
Yeah. Let's see. I'll read one here. Alexander writes, my favorite RNG gaming story comes from Metal Gear Solid 3 Snake Eater. I was in the Russian facility, and I got made by a guard. They were chasing me, and I ran into a wood-paneled conference room. Crap, no way out. Okay, let's just try it. I equip the wood grain face paint and camo and press up against the wood wall. 95% camo index. Guards run in, are completely mystified that the room is totally empty, patrol around a bit. Guards run back out, and I'm like, I cannot believe that actually worked.
That's fantastic.
That's super like Life of Brian, Monty Python's Life of Brian. All the Roman soldiers run in and then they can't find anybody. We got a spoon, sir. Okay. God.
that is the positive side of the Hideo Kojima game kind of thing, where it's like, it just, man, that like nobody else would have taken that small mechanical detail into account. You know, but the fact that it is there, it makes that perfect story. I mean, that probably, you know, I don't want to speak for Alex, but like probably raises their estimation of the entire game.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like the once that works once, you're looking for it to work again constantly.
Yeah. You know, I think fondly of Metal Gear Solid 5, not just because it's a really good game, but because I failed at doing a non-lethal approach to a mission because I used a tranquilizer on a guy, and he fell asleep immediately and fell over and $1 million babied himself on a post, and that caused him to die. So, that's not a random number generator, but that is the Kojima stuff. And let's see here, Ben, what does Skylar say? Round us out.
It's good. Skylar says, Gary's not here to say it, so I will. The Binding of Isaac, which has probably collected twice as many hours as every other game combined. Roguelikes as a genre make RNG a staple, where learning the game well enough to ride the waves of powerful items or be able to draw through bad situations is an insanely satisfying accomplishment. Whether it's Isaac, Gungeon, or Darkest Dungeon, a well-tuned roguelike is like a roulette machine you can't stop playing.
Yeah. And I'll just do mine real quick because they mentioned the probably the most random thing that I've played recently, Darkest Dungeon. What I enjoy with that is the way that they handle death and the way that they handle the major afflictions that you get. So if you max out your sanity meter, you have a chance to go to either get this affliction, which is, you know, a really big deal. Gets in the way, makes you lose turns and stuff like that. But there's a chance, there's a very small chance that instead you will become virtuous, and the stress will actually make you like super effective. You know, and the fact that, you know, this, you know, thing that you're trying to control against, you don't want to max out your stress. You don't want to, get the affliction, and you're just waiting. You see, okay, max it out. Hold your breath, and then when it becomes virtuous at a time when it is really, really decisive, That is so incredibly good. You know, that is, yes, it is, you know, random because it's kind of a coin flip. I know it's more complicated than that, but it's all in the presentation. Same thing with the way they handle death. If you are, you know, bottomed out on health, every hit that you take has a certain chance to kill you. Running out of health doesn't automatically, you know, kill you. And so you end up in these situations where you flip the coin and you get heads like 6 or 7 times in a row and you kill an enemy on borrowed time, or like they have a damage over time. My last person is alive. You know, I'm not going to be able to get out of here unless 2 more turns and then he's down. Yes. You know, just because you ended up getting the good side of it, you know, great way at least to present the random number generator in a way that really plays up kind of almost a sports like drama to some of those battles.
Yeah, it's amazing how often the great stories come when things are out of our control and things are left to chance. That's, you know, it can be the most frustrating things, but it's also the things that you talk about.
Yeah. Java.
Abyss Odyssey.
Cool. That's a roguelike. Yeah.
It's very neat.
is that the Chilean game?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Nice. And that's that's proc gen roguelike, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Correct.
Not bad. Ben, how about you?
I think one creative use that I really like is in multiplayer games. So I'm thinking specifically in like Jackbox. Mm-hmm. And the like adversarial games, or like Fall Guys, where it's like a random door is blocked and a random one is free, and you have to like figure out which one it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, how weird is it that we got Fall Guys and Squid Game within like a year? and Dennis, how about
is
you?
Is that one of the scenarios where like they have to have been in production independently of each other?
Squid Game was in development for like 10 years. So,
gotcha.
Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah. Crazy.
I don't think we've covered it on the show, but have you guys heard of Crab Game?
Crab
Game? Like jank multiplayer game that's Squid Game.
Yeah, I saw a story about it. Looks fun.
Yeah.
Dennis, how about you?
Yeah, I am going to go with XCOM, even though we had an example of it being very jank. And it does present a lot of very jank RNG situations. But it also presents it in a context where you kind of know exactly how much time or how many turns you have, how many actions you have to get to your desired result. Mm-hmm. And so it's great. Like, okay, I could fix this with one action that has a 65% chance of succeeding. If that doesn't fail, I could fix it with these two other actions that combined have an 80% chance of succeeding. And if, you know, that doesn't work, then I got to do X, Y. And so even though it's highly random, you always have this check down system that allows you to be creating backup plan after backup plan after backup plan,
right,
within your turn. Which is really cool.
Nice. I feel like, you know, we've talked about XCOM at length, but I feel like the unreliability of their figures is only a problem when you are expecting reliability. And then you can kind of plan against it, or, you know, understand that you cannot plan around it.
Yeah. Well, it's all seeded RNG. So like the same action and the same positioning will always yield the same result.
Right.
But the problem is the way you get to those numbers is often very arcane.
Yeah.
So it's consistent, but there is such a steep learning curve.
Right.
In being like, okay, if I move my character to this thing that looks like it's in a corner, that actually expands my line of sight in a certain way while I'm moving, that is likely to proc an enemy group. And you have to really, really learn that stuff to gain it. And even then you still have to be very good at having your check down plans.
Right.
It feels similar to like Civilization to me, where it's like they say parts of it are random, but there's definitely like a server behind it that's doing certain things, like spawning infinite people out of a ship that's near your, you know. Like,
yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm.
And you might not even be aware of it on like a conscious or verbal level, the particular things you're keeping account of. Yeah. Good. Mm-hmm. Good question.
Thanks. Yeah. Good answers.
Yeah. I could have sworn Jala would have done this one because of SMT. because of Shin Megami Tensei and the Pokemon.
No, appeal. And I didn't want to pick that one.
Oh,
like as my game choice, because like once I finish SMT5, I think I'll set it down and I probably won't go back to it. But I do periodically go back and play Abyss Odyssey, so
yeah,
it has more shelf life. I guess another instance of that would also be Azure Dreams. That's also a roguelike.
Oh yeah.
So.
Cool. If you would like to participate in these, you can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/thelevelpodcast, and watch for the prompts to go up on Monday afternoons. Thanks, Dennis, for putting this one up this week. And thank you, everybody, for responding.
The end boss.
Now it is time for the end boss, where we're talking about things that are happening in the world of video games. Jala, what's the story that you brought?
So patents exist everywhere. And in the world of video games, it's no exception. So 58% of all gamers want historical accuracy in games, with another 21% saying it depends on the type of game. Some were okay with alternate histories, for example. Overall, this was like a survey that was done. Overall, the respondents prioritized the fun and entertainment over the accuracy, but some folks felt any changes to historical records should be disclosed to players in some way, which seems real weird to me. Like, how do you want? You want an asterisk next to all of that so you could go check your menu and see how it's different from the actual? Like, that's so weird.
The anyway, aliens. It's the aliens, Karen.
I don't even know. Well, anyway, so the article kind of talks a little bit about different ways in which games have been making attempts to be historically accurate. For example, the development of L.A. Noire. Over 180,000 sources, including newspaper articles, photographs, and police records, were examined to ensure that the city was remodeled and recreated accurately. And of course, Assassin's Creed is very well known for having historians and academics as consultants and recreating very detailed versions of historical cities for its games, although stuff like the tower that's on Notre Dame, for example, that wasn't even added at the time that they did the game, but they put that in there anyway because it's iconic and whatever. But like for the most part, it's pretty accurate. And of course, like what is it, the subway maps and stuff that were such a big deal in what, Fallout or something?
I can't remember,
or some other game. Anyway, like there's some kind of subway maps for actual city plans that were used in some post-apocalyptic game or something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the article mentioned that the different ways that this research can be used, for example, in marketing, if companies wanted to, like branded podcasts or social media or tie-in books and website content. So like tie-in books, I'd be down for. Mm-hmm. Like here's the actual history of the thing that went on or whatever, or, you know, here's our alternate history of whatever. And then that's where you can put your little footnotes about.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want a little dialogue box popping up in the middle of my game telling me, hey, by the way, this is totally a fake thing. Like, it's a video game. Yes. Thank you. Anyway, I also found out about History Respond podcast. I've not listened to it yet, but I want to check it out. It explores the history presented in popular video games. That seems like interesting subject matter to me.
Yeah.
So I wanted to bring this story for that reason. Not so much to say, hey, guess what? Patents. But more like, hey, there's this podcast about this thing and I want to go check it out. And I don't know. How do you guys feel about history in video games? Like, I like it. I like it, you know, but what do you think, Dennis?
I was going to say, I'm going to be pedantic about this from a stats perspective. Like 58% of players felt, you know, whatever is well within a standard deviation on the bell curve anyway. Yeah. And like the other headline is, you know, 42% of players want people to maximize the changes to the historical record. Like that feels more interesting to me.
Yeah.
And then also the context of like, well, but you know, they said it should happen, but they said it should happen not at the expense of the fun of the game. It just, I don't know.
Yeah. It's, yeah. Oh, I know.
I think an important distinction to draw in terms of, you know, historical accuracy is that accuracy and treating your source material with respect are not necessarily one and the same. True. You can have something that is not historically accurate, yet still treats its source material with respect or kind of gives it its due. And you can have things that are accurate but still flippant or not sensitive in the way they portray those accuracies. So mm-hmm. I think really what I'm after when I say I want historical accuracy in a game is I want the game to treat whatever source material it's drawing from with respect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think you can do that while still embellishing or departing. I like the idea of using a game with historical ties as a jumping off point to learn more about that piece in history. But I certainly don't expect the game to do all of that for me.
Can't be mm-hmm. a primary source.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I agree with what you're saying, Dennis. And the game I keep thinking about when you're talking about this, Assassin's Creed, where they definitely embellish on a lot of different things in history. Like they make Pythagoras a magician. But they like a lot of accuracy like shines through in the game, like, you know, like just the settings of like a quarry or like sailing in the Aegean Sea and stuff like that. Like all that stuff really kind of harkens to like that sort of place. And it seems like it's respectful of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Assassin's Creed Odyssey. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, definitely, though. Pythagoras was wackadoodle. If you actually look up stuff about this guy, yeah. Anyway, sorry. Continue.
Don't get me started on Pliny. But yeah, no. I generally prefer what's fun. I think that it's I'm pretty much in line. I'm always my ears perk up when somebody starts talking about historical accuracy because. It runs into the stuff we were talking about at the beginning with Battlefield 1. And it's like, mm-hmm. you know, just oftentimes an appeal to history is an appeal against any kind of things that feel like modern, but it's actually, no, you're making this into an identity thing because like, no, obviously it was all white men and this has to be a game about white men. When, mm-hmm. you know, that might not have been the case. So, you know, I tend to keep my ear open for if that might be what somebody's talking about. But, you know, I generally prefer fun, but also history makes for interesting subject matter. And it's cool if they can be accurate.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, for sure. But it's like I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about it and I'm like, would I have more fun in Dishonored if it was in a historically accurate place? No, I don't think I would have any more fun.
Yeah.
Potentially less fun because, like, say in Dishonored 2, the crazy lab place is like pretty baller, but I'm pretty sure that's not an actual thing anybody has ever conceived of building.
Yeah.
So,
like, an example of this in LA Noir that I think is actually like pretty good is. A major set piece, quite literally, in that is the set for the D.W. Griffith film Intolerance. You know, that was shot in like 1916 and the game takes place in 1947, I think. It's post-war. That would not have been up. However, it is, you know, it was this gigantic set that was up for a very long time and would have been, you know, really it's just there because it was a cool thing to play this mission on. It's fine. Also, there's a codex in the game that says, yeah, this wasn't here at that time, but wasn't that mission fun running over this, you know?
Yeah. Rule of fun.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so I've got one. HBO is slowly announcing production details for The Last of Us television show. And they made a casting announcement that I think is actually inspired. Really? Mm-hmm. So the character of Bill, who you in the game, like he's a person who has this town full of traps. Who Joel goes to meet him, and you have to fight your way through his traps. And he's real gruff, kind of a loner survivalist kind of guy. They announced who would be cast as Bill in the story, and it's Nick Offerman, the actor for Ron Swanson from Parks and Rec, and that is mm-hmm. just a really good fit that is inspired casting, in my opinion, and I think it is the casting decision that has made me the most interested in this show. Previously, I was a little bit like, yeah, I feel like I got that story. You know, it's the game is cinematic enough. Nick Offerman is a good and entertaining actor, so I'm curious to see what he brings to that role, which is, you know, funny but also has a certain amount of poignancy and tragedy to it.
Yeah, I mean, everything in that universe is going to stab you in the gut at some point with just really wrenching stuff, and his character, even though it's comic relief, is no different. Mm-hmm. The weird thing to me is from what I'm seeing, it seemed like they had found someone for the role. And then that person, Con O'Neill, which I looked him up. I didn't recognize him from anything.
Yeah.
But Nick Offerman is replacing him because Con O'Neill had a scheduling conflict.
Yeah.
Which could be true, but my cynical side goes like, oh, they were just able to find, Nick Offerman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Con O'Neill has, several episodes for the show listed on his filmography already.
Oh wow, they must have shot.
That's yeah, what's surprising me is that either means he was a little too hasty or the internet was a little too hasty in adding him, or he actually did significant work on this that's going to get retaken, which is a little bit sad, but
yeah.
Also Nick Offerman.
Yeah, it's Nick Offerman, and that happens quite frequently too.
Mm-hmm. Can I also express some cynical sentiment?
Yes.
I also just connected that both the Last of Us and Uncharted are. So it's like maybe somebody at Naughty Dog was just like, fuck it. Like, we're making things now. Like, I don't care about quality. Like,
yeah, just push it bank. Out.
they saw the writing of Arcane on the walls and are like, oh, this is a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, it had to be in production for a while, and Sony has famously been working on Uncharted. I was going to say Last of Us forever, but certainly the recent successes have lit a fire under various studios' asses.
Yeah, and those stories and publicity can play off of each other. Now, if the Uncharted movie comes out and it is shit, that will be bad for the show and vice versa. But I think with the cast, and also, I mean, just a TV show is such a better choice for adapting a video game anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Speaking
of, I mean, we're all going to watch it, right? So
I'll give it a shot. You know, if it's
hopefully I won't hate it.
Yeah. Speaking of Naughty Dog and Uncharted, Dennis, what is going on with Uncharted?
Yeah. I didn't mean to make this the Naughty Dog cast. But a little fun promotion as they are coming up on the Uncharted movie is that if you upgrade to the PS5 version of any of the games, Thief's End or Lost Legacy, you get a free movie ticket
nice.
To the Uncharted movie. So you do have to be in, I think it's the US, UK, or somewhere else relatively large marketed. But you know, it's a nice little extra. And in general, I think it's cool what they're doing, because if you have either Uncharted 4 or the kind of spin-off game Lost Legacy, you can upgrade to the PS5 bundle that has both of them for $10. So you you can basically get double the game for one if you've only bought one of those.
Mm-hmm.
But the kind of crappy thing is that in the process of doing this, they are delisting those games from the store. So you now are not able to buy the basic version of them anymore.
Oh, weird.
Which I don't like. And then the other weird thing is if you own the games as a physical copy, you can still do the $10 upgrade, but you'll still have to put that physical copy in every time you play.
Weird.
Meaning
and bad.
If you have a no disc drive PS5, you're SOL.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ugh. So that kind of sucks.
So
and
messy.
It's just these weird growing pains of getting away from physical media.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, hellish march that is happening, and I don't think we can really stop, but, you know, we're seeing these kind of weird things happen with it.
I can stop. I can't stop it, but I can fight it.
It'll go the way of the record player. Or wait, I mean the CD player.
Oh, wait, no. The cassette tape. Oh, wait, no. Oh, God, people like all these things. Shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Progress. Progress has been really good on the whole. So the not to make everything a kid story, but I thought of something talking about Naughty Dog. Because earlier today, Milo was asking over and over again, can we listen to the Christmas song about the Naughty Dog?
Okay.
And I was not able to make that connection on my own. I don't know if any of you guys are able to make it initially.
No, I can't.
Then he goes, you know, the one in Spanish.
Oh, Feliz Navidad. Yeah, there we go.
Feliz Navidad.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, man. I love any of those little kid mishearing things.
That was fun.
That's good. Finally here, Ben, what synergy is Wizards of the Coast getting up to?
Yeah, this is something that's really cool. I didn't know they were going to do this, but over the summer, they had a map set come out called Strixhaven, which was D&D themed.
Mm-hmm.
And so mechanics in the magic set were, you know, about going through a dungeon and stuff like that, and like having a rolling D20s and stuff like that. They integrated a lot of components of D&D into the magic mechanics.
Ooh.
And they've kind of turned a compliment and gone the other way around with it, where they made a magic D&D book of this setting, that they had in the magic set. So it's like a D&D like a game book where it's like a campaign that is supposed to last like maybe like four sittings.
You intend it to last 4 years, but then it goes seven,
and that's so just one round. Yeah,
they said four like sittings or whatever. But they said it was supposed to be like four sittings, but it also says that your characters go from level 1 to 10.
Oh, so yeah.
Wow. I could imagine it might stretch out longer and could go for like a month or half a year, depending on how frequently you meet.
It's probably intentional on their part to build a ceiling into that if you want to.
And they mentioned that as well. There's like a way to monetize, so you could just do a one-off if you wanted to, but you just change some of the story beats.
Yeah.
But it sounds like a really cool campaign. It's basically like Harry Potter, but magic themed, like Magic the Gathering themed.
Mm-hmm.
Good clarification. So
like, yeah, they have like five houses instead of four houses
to match with the elements.
Yeah, I think it's something that's like slightly more complicated, where it's like it's not just this house is green, this is red or whatever. Each house is like two colors, so there's like a green black house that deals with like death and necromancy. That's like Slytherin essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Can we
have 25 houses then?
So I think they pick five. So they just pick.
Right. They don't do every combination.
Yeah, they do that in other like settings, and it's. I think it's whatever. There's like five choose two and five choose three that they do in a couple different places, and so but they don't do that here. Anyway, whatever. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it seems like a really cool campaign. People are into. Like short one-off that you could do, especially if you also like magic. So
mm-hmm. I'm real surprised that they haven't done that. They hadn't done this before.
I know that there's like some degree of crossover with them, but I don't remember to what extent.
It's been real subtle, like, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The set that they did for magic was a lot of fun with the D&D. Like, you know, they had like original D&D books were kind of mechanics in the magic set that you could use and that mm-hmm. you could like go through. So yeah, so it's cool to see. I mean, they're both under the same company, you know, so it's not like it's two, you know, different people paying compliments to one another. It's kind of someone patting themselves on the back,
right.
But it's still like cool to see the integration and the crossover. It's kind of fun.
And that it was done well, you know, it wasn't just a cash in. If they wanted to cash in on this, they would have done it back in like 2001 when Wizards bought TSR. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. I'm going to go on record as not liking the everything is a multiverse.
Yeah. Yeah.
Trend that we're seeing in everything, like every company that, or, you know, holding company that has more than one property is trying to figure out how to make them keys. And I don't like it.
Sorry, that was funny.
I might try and defend magic here, but like every like universe, and they have like a whole like narrative behind it where there's people who can like go between them and stuff. But that's their excuse for doing what you're talking about, which is being like,
yeah,
we want to do this theme this time, so we're going to do that.
Yeah. I can like I can see it in the world of Magic. It's like when Battlefield starts doing it. It's like, fuck off.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like D&D has Planescape as well to step in on the D&D side. You know, they've been, you know, like what is it? Ravenloft is a spinoff of the Dragonlance stuff. Or the other way around. No, I think Dragonlance came first. So there's precedent for that there. It is not, I mean, I'm not going to say it's not entirely, that it is not at least somewhat crassly commercial. It is not entirely crassly commercial.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Well, I think that that wraps it up. How do you feel about buttoning it up?
I feel buttons.
Thanks so much, everybody, for listening to this episode of The Level. Like I alluded to at the beginning, Duckstream is coming up. It is the next weekend after you're hearing this. We're going to be announcing a schedule, the big event that we are planning. We're going to be doing, can we announce this, Jala?
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to be doing a kind of a tabletop campaign, kind of like we did for your birthday. It's going to be Adam Bucherry DMing for us again, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. So
and
we'll...
it's going to it's going to be kind of a fast and loose version of Kobolds Ate My Baby, which mostly I just like the fact that you play kobolds and that they are drawn in such a cute way. I just want reasons to draw very cute kobolds doing silly, silly things and dying a lot. And we had we played a test game and it was super fun. So looking forward to playing that with you guys on stream.
It'll be a good time and we're doing it for a good cause. So watch for details on that and hang around the entire weekend. Spread the word, participate in chat, even if you are unable to donate money, which we understand if you are not. That is to it's an event that we're doing to raise money for the Trans Active Gender Center. I think this is the 7th or 8th one we've done. Time is meaningless. but yeah, it'll be a good time. Otherwise, though, you know the stuff you can do to help us out. Don't want to belabor the point. So I think we can call it a night unless I'm forgetting anything huge.
No.
All right. So I've been Cole Ross. You can find me on Twitch at Duckfeed TV.
I've been Dennis Furia. You can find me at Deck of Wonders on Instagram.
I'm Jalachan in places. You can find me there, maybe.
And I've been Ben Merkel.
And stick around for some titles.
Terrible. I don't have any titles. Sorry.
no worries. There's usually at least one. I have two. I have A Month of Cheddar Bay Biscuits, which I like for how baroque it is. But I also have those right there, Riding the Crawfish, which is good. I would lean toward A Month of Cheddar Bay Biscuits, but Riding the Crawfish also works.
It does have a nice cadence to it, the first one.
Yeah. Dennis, how about you?
Yeah, I had Riding the Crawfish as well. I also had Menorah of Mass Destruction.
Appropriate to the season.
It is.
Hanukkah just ended, so.
Yeah. Ben, how about you?
I just had There's Menorahs Involved. Stop there.
Does anybody
I'll vote for A Month of Cheddar Bay Biscuits.
Okay. Is everybody okay with that?
I can't argue with that.
Okay. Okay, cool. A Month of Cheddar Bay Biscuits. All right, I'm gonna go. I've been awake for a very long time today because I didn't really sleep last night, so and I got a cat rubbing up against my ankle, so I'm gonna go play with her for a minute.
Greta did not make an appearance in this episode.
Dottie was chill. Oh, wow. Yeah, she hopped up on the desk like for a little bit, but she didn't interfere with anything, so
Maybe they tired themselves out fighting about the strawberries.
the battle of the strawberry has been epic. Oh, it's adorable. And they crush it flat, and then they look at me to put it back, and it's like, hey, you guys made your bed.
Very cool.
Cool. Take care, everybody.
Yep. All right. See you around.
See you. Bye.
Night-night.